barred window of the registry, waiting his turn to hand in a tray of full classified papers. He isn't expecting me, but nothing much surprises him anymore, so I say, "Hello, Alec, great to see you." And Alec says, "Oh, hello, Peter, it's you, and what the hell are you doing here?" Then, after some uncharacteristic hesitation, he asks me whether I'm tied up for the weekend, and I say I am, actually, to which he says, "Oh, pity, I thought you might come with me to Dusseldorf." And I say, "Why on earth Dusseldorf?" And he does some more hesitation. "I just need to get out of bloody Berlin for once," he says, with an unconvincing shrug of indifference. And because he seems to accept that I could never in my wildest dreams imagine him as a casual tourist, "Gotta see a man about a dog," he explains, from which I take it that he wishes me to understand that he has a Joe he's got to take care of, and I might in that case be useful to him as a foil or a backup or whatever. But that's no reason to stand up Dagmar. "Can't do, I'm afraid, Alec. A Scandinavian lady needs my undivided attention, and I need hers." He thinks about this for a while, but not in a way that I associate with Alec. It's as if he feels hurt or puzzled. A registry clerk is gesturing impatiently on the other side of the grill. Alec hands over his papers. The clerk signs them in. "A woman would be good," he says, without looking at me. "Even a woman who thinks I'm from the Ministry of Labour, scouting for German scientific talent. Come off it." "Bring her, she'll be fine," he says. And if you knew Alec as well as I did, that was as close to a cry for help as you would ever hear from him. In all the years we'd hunted together amid all the ups and downs, I had never once seen him at a loss, till now. Dagmar is game, so the same evening the three of us fly the corridor to Helmstedt, pick up a car, drive to Dusseldorf, and book into a hotel, Alec knows. Over dinner he barely speaks, but Dagmar, who is turning out to be a real trooper, more than holds her own, and we slip off to bed early and have our carnal night. Both parties thoroughly pleased with themselves. Saturday morning we all meet for a late breakfast, and Alec says he's got tickets for a football match. I'd never in my life heard Alec express the smallest interest in football. Then it turns out he's got 4 tickets. "Who's the fourth?" I ask him, fantasizing that he's got a secret love tucked away who's only available on Saturdays. "Kid I know," he says. We get into the car, Dagmar and self in the back, and off we go. Alec pulls up at a street corner. A tall, rigid-faced boy in his teens is standing under a Coca-Cola sign waiting for him. Alec shoves open the door. The boy jumps into the front seat and Alec says, "This is Christoph." So we say, "Hello, Christoph," and off we drive to the stadium. Alec speaks German as well as he speaks English, probably better, and he speaks it to the boy in undertones. The boy grunts, nods, or shakes his head. How old is he? 14, 18? Whatever age he is the eternal German adolescent of the authoritarian class. Sullen, spotty, and resentfully obedient. He's blonde, pallid, and square-shouldered, and for a kid he doesn't smile a lot. On a rise, set back from the touchline, he and Alec stand side by side and exchange the odd word I can't hear, but the boy doesn't cheer. He stares, and at half-time the two of them disappear, I'm assuming for a pee or a hot dog. But only Alec returns. "Where's Christoph?" I ask. "Had to head back home," he replies gruffly. "Mum's orders." And for the rest of the weekend, that was that. Dagmar and I spent more happy times in bed, and what Alec got up to, I have no idea. I just assumed that Christoph was the son of one of his Joes and needed an outing, because with Joes it's welfare first and everything else second. It wasn't till I was about to return to London and Dagmar was safely back in Stockholm with her husband, and Alec and I were having a farewell drink together in one of his many favourite Berlin watering holes, that I asked him casually, "How's Christoph?" Because it had crossed my mind that the boy had seemed a bit astray, a bit hard to please. And probably I even said something to this effect. At first I thought I was going to get another of those odd silences because he turned away from me so that I couldn't see his face. "I'm his bloody father, for Christ's sake," he said. And then in short, reluctant bursts, mostly without verbs and not even bothering to tell me to keep it to myself because he knew I would, the story, or as much of it as he was willing to tell. German woman courier he'd used when he was based in Bern and she lived in Dusseldorf. Good girl, good pals. Had a fling with her. Wanted me to marry her. Wouldn't. So she married a local lawyer. Lawyer adopted the boy, only decent thing he ever did. She lets me see him now and then. Can't tell her bloody husband or the bastard would beat her up. And the final image that I'm seeing now as I rouse myself from my austerity chair. Alec and the boy Christoph, standing shoulder to shoulder, staring rigidly at the match. And the same set expression on their faces. And the same Irish jaw. At some point in the night I must have slept, but had no memory of it. The time in Dolphin Square is 6 a.m, in Brittany 7. Catherine will be up and about by now. If I was at home, I would be up and about too, because Isabel starts her singing as soon as Chevalier, our chief cockerel, starts his. Her voice carries straight across the courtyard from Catherine's cottage because Isabel needs her bedroom window open at all times, never mind the weather. They will have fed the goats their breakfast and Catherine will be feeding Isabel hers, probably in a chase game round the courtyard with Isabel escaping and Catherine coming after her with a spoonful of yogurt. And the chickens, under the useless command of Chevalier, generally behaving as if the world is ending. As I picture this scene, it crossed my mind that if I called the main house and Catherine happened to be passing and had her keys with her, she might hear the ring and answer it. So I gave it a shot on the off chance, using one of my disposable mobile phones, because I was damned if I was going to have Bunny listening. There's no answering system on the farm phone, so I let it ring for a few minutes and was just giving up hope when I heard Catherine's voice, which is Breton, and sometimes a little more severe than perhaps she intends. You are well, Pierre? Fine, you too, Catherine? You have said goodbye to your friend who died? Still a couple of days to go. You will make a big speech? Enormous. You are nervous? Terrified. How's Isabel? Isabel is well. She is not changed in your absence. By now I'd noticed an undertone of annoyance or something stronger in her voice. A friend came to visit you yesterday. You were expecting a friend, Pierre? No. What sort of a friend? But like every tough questioner, Catherine has her own way with answers. I told him, no, Pierre is not here. Pierre is in London. He is being a good Samaritan. Somebody has died. He has gone to comfort those who are grieving. But who was he, Catherine? He didn't smile. He was not polite. He was persistent. You mean he made a pass at you? He asked who had died. I said, I don't know. He asked, why don't I know? I said, because Pierre does not tell me everything. He laughed. He said, maybe at Pierre's age all friends are dying. He asked, was it sudden? Was it a woman, a man? He asked, do you stay in a hotel in London? Which one? What is the address? What is the name? I say, I don't know. I am busy. I have a child and a farm. Was he French? Maybe German, maybe American. Did he come by car? Taxi from the station, with Gascon. First you pay me, Gascon told him, otherwise I don't drive you. What did he look like? He was not agreeable, Pierre. Farouche. Big, like a boxer. Many rings on his fingers. Age? Maybe 50, 60. I did not count his teeth, maybe more. Did he tell you his name? He said it was not necessary. He said you are old friends. He said you watch football together. I lie motionless, barely breathing. I think I should get out of bed, but I have a fuite de courage. How the devil, Christoph, son of Alec, litigant, purloiner of closed Stasi files, criminal with a record as long as your arm, did you find your way to Brittany? The farmstead at Les Deux Églises had come down to me on my mother's side. It still bore her maiden name. There was no Pierre Guillaume in the local phone book. Had Bunny, for his own arcane reasons, slipped Christoph my address? To what conceivable purpose? Then I remember my motorcycle pilgrimage to a rain-swept cemetery in Berlin on a pitch-dark winter's day in 1989, and everything makes sense. The Berlin Wall has been down a month. Germany is ecstatic, our village in Brittany a little less so. And I seem to be hovering somewhere between the two, one minute rejoicing that peace of a sort has broken out, then lapsing into introspection as I think of the stuff we did and the sacrifices we made, not least of other people's lives, in the long years when we thought the war was going to be there forever. It was in this uncertain mood that I was wrestling with the farmstead's annual tax returns in the counting room at Les Deux Églises, when our new young postman, Denis, not yet dignified by Monsieur, and certainly not Le Général, arrived not by yellow van but by pushbike, and handed a letter not to me but to old Antoine, a one-legged war veteran, who as usual was hanging around the courtyard with a pitchfork in his hands and nothing in particular to do. Having examined the envelope front and back and conceded that I might have it after all, Antoine hobbled to the door, presented me with it, then stood back to scrutinize me while I read the contents. Muren, Switzerland. Dear Peter, I thought you would wish to know that the ashes of our friend Alec have recently been laid to rest in Berlin, close to the spot where he died. It seems that the bodies of those murdered at the wall were customarily incinerated in secret and their ashes dispersed. Thanks to meticulous Stasi records, however, it appears that exceptional steps were taken in Alec's case. His remains have come to light, and he has been given a decent, if belated, funeral. As ever, George. And on a separate sheet of paper, old habits die hard, the address of a small cemetery in the Berlin district of Friedrichshain, officially set aside for victims of war and tyranny. I was with Diane at the time, another passing fancy nearing its end. I think I told her that a friend was ill, or maybe that the friend had died. I jumped on my motorbike, it was still those days, drove myself non-stop to Berlin through some of the worst weather I'd ever come across, went straight to the cemetery and asked at the entrance where I could find Alec. Dense, non-stop rain. An old man who was some kind of sacristan gave me an umbrella and a map and pointed me down a long grey avenue of trees. After hunting around, I found what I was looking for. One fresh grave, one marble headstone inscribed Alec Johannes Limas, washed eerily white by the rain. No dates, no job description, and a full-length mound to indicate a body where only ashes lay. For cover? All those years of knowing you, I thought, and you never told me about the Johannes. Typical. I hadn't brought flowers. I thought he'd laugh at me. So I stood under my umbrella and had a sort of internal dialogue with him. As I was getting back on my bike, the old man asked me whether I'd like to sign the condolence book. Condolence book? It was his personal duty to maintain one, he explained. Not so much a duty, more as a service to the departed. So I said, why not? The first entry was signed G.S. Address, London. In the tributes column, the one word, friend. So that was George, or as much of him as he was willing to admit to. Below George, a bunch of German names that meant nothing to me, with tributes like never forgotten, until we reached the one name, Christoph, on its own. No surname after it. And under tributes, the word Sohn, son, and under home address, Dusseldorf. Was it a passing fit of euphoria about the wall coming down and all the world being free again, which I severely doubt, or a gut feeling that I'd done enough secrecy in my life, or simply an urge to stand up in the pouring rain and be counted as another of Alec's friends? Whatever it was, I did the lot. Wrote down my real name, my real address in Brittany and in the tributes column because I couldn't think of anything better. Piero, which was what Alec called me on the rare occasions he was feeling affectionate. And Christoph, my farouche fellow mourner and Alec's son? What did you do? On one of your later visits to your father's grave, I am assuming on no particular grounds that you made a few more, if only for research purposes, you happened to take another look in the condolence book. And what did you see? Peter Gwillem and Les Deux Églises written out for you en clair. Not an alias, not a cover address or a safe house. Just the unprotected me and where I live. And that's what got you all the way to Brittany from Dusseldorf. So what's your next move, Christophe, son of Alec? I'm hearing Bunny's fruity legal voice from yesterday. Christophe is not without his talents, Peter. Perhaps the genes help. 6. Pete here is our reader, Laura had declared to her admiring audience. For his reading, Pete will be accommodated here in the library. I see myself in the days that followed, not so much as a reader as some sort of senior student forced to sit an examination he should have taken half a lifetime ago. Intermittently, the late developer is hauled out of the examination room and compelled to undergo a viva voce by examiners whose knowledge of his subject is mysteriously uneven, but that doesn't stop them from trying to give him a hard time. Intermittently, he's so appalled by the antics of his earlier self that he's on the verge of denying them until the evidence condemns him out of his own mouth. Each morning on arrival, I am served with a wad of folders, some familiar, some not. Just because you've stolen a file doesn't mean you've read it. On the morning of my second day, the library remained closed to all comers. From the thumps that issued from it and the scurrying of tracksuited young men and women I wasn't introduced to, I assumed an all-night fingertip search. Then, by afternoon, an ominous quiet. My desk was not a desk, but a trestle table set gallows-like at the center of the library floor. The bookshelves were gone, leaving only a ghostly imprint like the shadow of prison bars on the Anad Lipda walls. When you hit a rosette, stop, Laura commands me, and departs. Rosette? She means the pink-headed paperclips wedged at intervals among the folders. Nelson silently assumes the invigilator's chair and opens a hefty paperback. Henri Troyat's Life of Tolstoy. Give us a shout if you want a pee break, right? My dad pees like every 10 minutes. Poor chap. Just don't take anything with you. A freak evening when Laura, without explanation, replaces Nelson on the invigilator's chair and, having surveyed me dourly for an hour and a half or more, says, "Fuck it. Want to take me out for a free meal, Pete?" "Now," I say. "Now, tonight. When do you think?" Free to whom, I'm wondering as I shrug my cautious acquiescence. Free to her? Me? Or free to both of us because the office is setting us up? We adjourn to a Greek restaurant up the road. She's booked a table. She's wearing a skirt. It's a corner table with an unlit candle in a red cage. I don't know why the image of the unlit candle lingers, but it does. And the patron leaning over us, lighting it and telling me I have the best view in the room, meaning Laura. We have an ouzo, then another. Straight, no ice, her idea. So is she a lush? Is she on the make? Me at my age, for Christ's sake? Or does she think alcohol is going to loosen the old fart's tongue? And what should I be making of the very ordinary middle-aged couple sitting at the next table and determinedly not looking at us? She's wearing a sleeveless halter top that sparkles in the candlelight and the neckline has slipped southward. We order the usual starters, tarama, hummus, whitebait. She adores moussaka, so we settle for two. And she starts on a different kind of interrogation, the flirtatious kind. So is it really true, Pete, what you told Bunny, that you and Catherine are just good friends? Because, frankly, Pete, voice softening to intimate, what with your record, how can you possibly be shacked up with a super attractive French girl you don't even shag? Unless, of course, you're secretly gay, which is what Bunny thinks. Mind you, Bunny thinks everyone's gay. So he's probably gay himself and won't admit it. One half of me wants to tell her to go to hell, the other half wants to know what she thinks she's up to. So I let it go. But I mean, honestly, Pete, it's crazy, she persists. I mean, don't tell me you've withdrawn your cavalry from the charge, as my dad used to say. An old stoat like you, you can't possibly. I ask her, against my better instincts, what makes her think Catherine is so attractive. And she says, oh, a little bird has told her. We're drinking Greek red, black as ink and taste like it. And she's leaning forward, giving me the full benefit of her neckline. So, Pete, tell me true. Scout's honor, okay? Of all the women you've bonked over the years, who gets the absolute number one slot? Her unfortunate choice of the word slot causing her to collapse in a fit of giggles. How about you first, I retort. And the joke's over. I call for the bill. The couple next door call for theirs. She says she'll take the tube. I say I'll walk a bit. And to this day, I have no idea whether she was on a mission to draw me out, or was she just another unattached soul looking for a bit of human warmth. I am the reader. The buff cover of the folder I am reading is blank except for the handwritten file reference, whose hand escapes me, but probably my own. The leading serial is marked Top Secret and Guard, which means keep it away from the Americans. And it is a report, apologia would be a better word, written by one Stavros de Jong, all 6'3" of him, an ungainly circus trainee of 25, Stas for short, is a Cambridge graduate with 6 months still to go before his confirmation. He's on attachment to Berlin Station's covert section, which is commanded by my comrade-in-arms in a string of abortive operations, the veteran fieldman, Alec Lemus. As a matter of protocol, Lemus, as local commander, is also de facto deputy head of station. Stas's report is accordingly addressed to Lemus in that capacity and forwarded to his head of covert in London, George Smiley. Report by S. de Jong to DH, Station Berlin, Lemus. Copy to JS, Joint Steering. I am instructed to submit the following report. New Year's Day being cold but sunny and a public holiday, my wife Pippa and I decided to take our children, Barney 3 and Lucy 5, and our Jack Russell, Loftus, to Köpenick, East Berlin, for a lakeside picnic in warm clothes and a ramble in the adjoining woods. Our family car is a blue Volvo estate with British military number plates front and rear, entitling us to unrestricted passage between Berlin sectors, Köpenick in East Berlin being one of our regular picnic spots and a favourite with the children. I parked, as per usual, beside the perimeter wall of Köpenick's old brewery, now abandoned. There was no other car in sight, and at the waterside only a few seated fishermen who ignored us. From the car, we carried our picnic basket through the woods to our usual grass promontory beside the lake, and afterwards played hide-and-seek with Loftus barking loudly, to the irritation of one of the fishermen who shouted abuse at us over his shoulder, insisting Loftus had disturbed the fish. The man was gaunt and in his 50s with greying hair, and I would recognize him if I saw him again. He wore a black peak cap and an old Wehrmacht topcoat stripped of its markings. It being by now around 15:30 hours and Barney due for his rest, we packed our picnic things together and let the children run ahead to the car carrying the basket between them, with Loftus following and barking. On reaching the car, however, they dropped the basket and ran back in alarm, followed by Loftus barking, to report that the driver's door had been forced open by a burglar who has completely stolen Daddy's camera, Lucy. The driver's door had indeed been forced and the handle broken, but the old Kodak camera, which I had inadvertently left in the glove compartment, had not been stolen, nor had my overcoat or the groceries and other provisions that we had picked up at the Naffy, which to our surprise was open on New Year's Day, before crossing into East Berlin. Far from committing a burglary, it transpired that the intruder had left a Memphis tobacco tin next to my camera. Inside it was a small nickel cartridge, which I immediately identified as a standard Minox container for sub-miniature film. Since today is a public holiday and I have recently attended an operational photography course, I decided that there were insufficient grounds at this stage to call out the station duty officer. On arriving home, I therefore immediately developed the film in our bathroom, which is windowless, using my service-issue equipment. By 2100 hours, having examined some 100 frames of developed negative under a magnifying glass, I alerted the deputy head of station, Limas, who instructed me to bring the material forthwith to headquarters and prepare a written report, which I duly did. I fully accept in hindsight that I should have taken the undeveloped film directly to Berlin Station for processing by photographic section, and that it was insecure and potentially disastrous for me as a probationer to undertake the development in my own home. In mitigation, I would like to repeat that 1st of January was a public holiday and that I was reluctant to rouse the station with what might have been a false alarm. Plus, I had passed my operational photography course at Sarat with straight A's. Nevertheless, I sincerely regret my decision and would like to state that I have learned my lesson. S to J. And along the bottom of the letter, Alex's enraged hand-scrawled note to his head of covert, Smiley. George, the stupid little bugger copied this lot to joint before anyone had a chance to stop him. That's education for you. Suggest you smooth-talk P. Allerline, B. Hayden, T. Esterhaz, and Roy Bloody Bland and company into believing it was a bum steer, i.e. no further action required, second-rate peddler material, etc. Alec. But Alec was never one to sit on his thumbs, least of all when his future career was in the balance. His contract with the circus was up for renewal. He was way past the age limit for field men, with precious little prospect of a cozy desk job in head office, which explains Smiley's somewhat untrusting account of what Alec did next. H. Covert Marylebone, Smiley, to control. Eyes only, personal, hand-delivered. Subject, A.L. H. Covert Berlin. And handwritten in George's own immaculate hand, C. You will be as surprised as I was that A.L. appeared unannounced on the doorstep of my Chelsea home at 10 o'clock last night. Anne being away on a health cure, I was alone in the house. He smelt of drink, not unusual, but was not drunk. He insisted I unplug the phone in the drawing room before we speak, and that, despite the prevailing very cold weather, we sit at the conservatory end overlooking the garden on the grounds that you can't bug glass. He then told me he had flown from Berlin by civilian plane that afternoon in order not to appear on the RAF flight list, which he suspects is routinely monitored by joint steering. For the same reason, he no longer trusts circus couriers. He first needed to know, had I put joint off the scent, as he had asked, regarding the Koepnik material. I replied that I believed I had been able to achieve this since it was well known that the Berlin station was besieged with offers of worthless peddler intelligence. He then produced the attached folded sheet of paper from his pocket, explaining that it was a summary, prepared by himself alone, of the material contained in the Koepnik cassettes, but without benefit of collateral from any other covert or overt source. I had two visions simultaneously. The one of George and Alec huddled head to head in the chilly conservatory in Bywater Street. The second of Alec alone the night before, crouched over his ancient Olivetti and a bottle of scotch in his smoke-filled basement office in the Olympic Stadium in West Berlin. The result of his labours lies before me. One grimy typewritten page, blotched by Tippex and encased in cellophane, text as follows. 1. Minutes of KGB Conference East Bloc Intelligence Services, Prague, 21st December 1957. 2. Name and rank, home-based KGB officers on attachment to Stasi directorates as of 5th of July 1956. 3. Identity of current Stasi head agents in sub-Saharan Africa. 4. Names, rank, and work names of all Stasi officers undergoing KGB training in USSR. 5. Location of 6 new covert Soviet signals installations in GDR and Poland as of 5th of July 1956. Turn a page and I'm back to Smiley's handwritten minute to control, not a crossing out. The rest of Alec's story runs as follows. Regularly each week after De Jong's scoop, if such it was, Alec commandeered the De Jong's family Volvo and dog, put $500 in the glove compartment together with a children's colouring book with the number of his direct line to Berlin station scrawled in it, threw his fishing gear into the back, I did not know until now that Alec fished, and I am inclined to doubt it, drove to Köpnik and parked where De Jong had parked at the same hour. With the dog beside him, he went fishing and waited. On the third attempt, he struck lucky. The $500 had been replaced by 2 cassettes. The children's colouring book with the phone number had gone. 2 nights later, back in West Berlin, he received a call on the direct line from a man who refused to give his name, but said he fished in Köpnik. Alec instructed him to present himself outside a given house number on the Kurfürstendamm at 7:20 the next evening, carrying the previous week's edition of Der Spiegel in his left hand. The resulting treff, i.e. covert meeting, as borrowed by Berlin Hans from German espionage vernacular, took place in a Volkswagen people carrier driven by De Jong and lasted 18 minutes. Mayflower, as Alec has arbitrarily christened him, at first refused to reveal his name, insisting the cassettes came not from himself, but from a friend inside the Stasi, whom he must protect. His own role was merely that of voluntary intermediary, he insisted, his motive not mercenary, but ideological. But Alec wasn't having this. Unsourced material delivered by an anonymous intermediary was a drug on the market, he said, so no deal. Finally, and only in response to Alec's entreaties, we are asked to believe, Mayflower produced a card from his pocket with the name Dr. Med Karl Remeck and the address of the Charité Hospital in East Berlin on one side, and on the back, an address in Köpenick, handwritten. It is Alec's conviction that Remeck had only been waiting to get the measure of his man before revealing himself, and that after 10 minutes he abandoned his reservations. But we should never forget the Irishman in Alec. So, to the obvious questions. Even if Dr. Remeck is who he says he is, who is his magic subsource? Are we dealing with yet another elaborate Stasi setup? Or, though it pains me to suggest it, are we dealing with something a little more home-brewed by Alec himself? In conclusion, Alec is asking with some passion, I have to say, to be allowed to develop Mayflower to the next stage without subjecting him to any of the usual searches and background checks which, as things stand, could not be conducted without the knowledge and assistance of joint steering. His reservations are well known to us both, and I venture to suggest we cautiously share them. Alec, however, exhibits no such restraint regarding his suspicions. Last night after the third scotch, it was Connie Sachs he had cast as Moscow Center's double agent within the circus, with Toby Esterhaz running a close second. His theory, based on nothing but his own whiskey-fueled intuition, was that the pair of them had got themselves caught up in a sex-driven folie à deux the Russians had found out and were blackmailing them. I finally got him to bed around 2 a.m., only to find him in the kitchen at 6 a.m. cooking himself bacon and eggs. The question is what to do. On balance, I'm inclined to let him have one more run with his Mayflower, which means effectively with his mysterious alleged subsource in the Stasi, on his own terms. As we both know, his days in the field are numbered, and he has every reason to extend them. But we also know that the hardest part of our work is to invest trust. Based on little more than instinct, Alec declares himself solidly convinced of Mayflower's bona fides. This can either be the inspired hunch of a veteran, or the special pleading of an aging field officer facing the natural end of his career. I respectfully recommend that we allow him to go forward in that knowledge. G.S. But control is not so easily won over. See following exchange. Control to G.S., seriously concerned that Limas is paddling his own canoe. Where are the other indicators? Surely we may test the intelligence in areas that in Limas's vision of things are not contaminated. G.S. to control. Have separately consulted FO and defense under a pretext. Both speak well of material, do not believe it is fabrication. Chicken feed as a prelude to a major deception always a possibility. Control to G.S. Puzzled why Limas does not consult his Berlin head of station. Backstage maneuverings of this sort do service no good. G.S. to control. Unfortunately, Alec regards his H station as anti-covert and pro-joint. Control to G.S. I cannot divest myself of a galère of top-notch officers on the unproven supposition that one of them is a bad apple. G.S. to control. I'm afraid Alec sees joint as a bad orchard. Control to G.S. Then perhaps it's he who should be pruned. Alex's next written offering is of a different order altogether. Immaculately typed and in a prose style far superior to his own. My immediate suspect as Alex's amanuensis is Stas de Jong, first-class honours in modern languages. So this time it's the 6'3" Stas I see crouched at the Olivetti in the smoke-filled basement in Berlin Station, while Alec prowls the room, puffing at one of his vile Russian cigarettes and dictating raucous Irish obscenities that de Jong discreetly omits. Encounter report, 2nd of February 1959, location, Berlin Safe House K2, present, DH Station Berlin, Alec Limas, Paul, and Karl Remek, Mayflower. Source, Mayflower. Second Treff, Beyond Secret, Personal and Private, from AL to H. Covert Marylebone. Source Mayflower, known to the GDR's elite as the Doctor of Köpenick, after Carl Zuckmayr's play of similar title, is physician of choice to a select coterie of ranking SED, Socialist Unity, i.e. Communist Party, and Stasi Prominenz, and their families, several of whom reside in Köpenick's lakeside villas and apartments. His leftist credentials are impeccable. His father, Manfred, a communist since the early 30s, fought with Thälmann in the Spanish Civil War and later joined the Red Orchestra Network against Hitler. During 1939-45 war, Mayflower smuggled messages for his father, who was hanged by the Gestapo at Buchenwald concentration camp in 1944. Manfred did not, therefore, live to see the coming of the revolution to East Germany, but his son Karl, for love of his father, was determined to be its devoted comrade. After excelling at high school, he studied medicine in Jena and Prague, qualified magna cum laude. Not content with working long hours in East Berlin's one teaching hospital, he opened up his family house in Köpenick, which he shares with aging mother Helga, as an informal surgery for selected patients. As a natural-born member of the GDR's elite, Mayflower is also tasked with medical missions of a sensitive nature. A ranking SED official contracts VD while on a visit to distant parts and doesn't wish his superiors to know. Mayflower obliges with a false diagnosis. A Stasi prisoner has died of heart failure under interrogation, but the death certificate must tell a different story. A high-value Stasi prisoner is about to be subjected to harsh treatment. Mayflower is required to check the prisoner's psychological and physical condition and assess tolerance. In view of these responsibilities, Mayflower has been awarded the status of Geheimer Mitarbeiter, Secret Collaborator, or GM for short, which requires him to report monthly to his Stasi controller, one Urs Albrecht, a functionary of no great imagination. Mayflower says his reports to Albrecht are selective, mostly invented, of no possible consequence. Albrecht, in return, has told him that he is a good doctor but a lousy spy. Exceptionally, Mayflower has also been granted a pass to the Little City, otherwise the Mayakovsky Ring in East Berlin, where many of the GDR's elite are accommodated, while being rigorously protected from the general public by the Jasinski Brigade, a specially trained unit. Although the Little City boasts its own medical center, not to mention privileged shop, kindergarten, etc., Mayflower is permitted to enter the hallowed area for the purpose of attending his illustrious private patients. Once inside the cordon, he reports, rules of discretion are relaxed. Gossip and intrigue are rife. Tongues loosened. Motivation. Mayflower's claimed motivation is discussed with GDR regime, father's communist dream seen as portrayed. Offer of service. Mayflower claims that Subsource Tulip, a female patient and Stasi employee, not only provided the catalyst for his self-recruitment, but is the source of the original sub-miniature cassettes that he deposited on her behalf in de Jong's Volvo. He describes Tulip as neurotic but extremely controlled and highly vulnerable. He insists that she is his patient and nothing more. He reiterates that neither he nor Tulip requires financial reward. Resettlement in the West in the event of compromise not yet discussed. See below. But we don't see below. Next day, Smiley himself flies to Berlin to take a look at this remake for himself and orders me to accompany him. Yet Source Mayflower is not the primary reason for our journey. Of much greater interest to him is the identity, access, and motivation of the neurotic but extremely controlled female subsource, codename Tulip. Dead of night in an unsleeping West Berlin swept by freezing winds of sleet and snow. Alec Limas and George Smiley sit cloistered with their new prospect, Carl Remek, a.k.a. Mayflower, over a bottle of Talisker, Alec's favorite, and for Remek, a first. I sit at Smiley's right shoulder. Berlin Safehouse K2 lies in the Fasanenstrasse at number 28. And is a stately and unlikely survivor of Allied bombing. It is built in the Biedermeier style with a pillared doorway, a bay window, and a good back exit leading onto the Uhrlandstrasse. Whoever chose it has a taste for imperial nostalgia and an operational eye. Some faces, try as they may, cannot conceal the good heart of their owners, and Remex is such a face. He is balding, bespectacled, and sweet. The word is simply not to be denied, never mind the medic's studious frown. Humanity breathes out of him. Recalling now that first encounter, I have to remind myself that in 1959 there was no great drama to an East Berlin doctor coming across to West Berlin. Many did, and not a lot ever went back, which was why the wall was built. The file's opening serial is typed and unsigned, for it is not a formal report, and I can only assume that the author is Smiley, and that, since no addressee is indicated, he is writing for the file, in other words, to himself. Asked to identify the process by which he entered what he describes as the chrysalis stage of his opposition to the GDR regime, Mayflower points to the moment when the Stasi's interrogators ordered him to prepare a woman for investigative confinement. The woman was a GDR citizen in her 50s, allegedly working for the CIA. She suffered from acute claustrophobia. Solitary confinement had already driven her half mad. Her screams as they nailed her into a box are with me still. Mayflower. In the wake of this experience, Mayflower, who claims he is not given to rash decisions, says he reappraised his situation from every angle. He had heard the party's lies at first hand, observed its corruption, hypocrisies, and abuse of power. He had diagnosed the symptoms of a totalitarian state posing as its opposite. Far from the democracy his father had dreamed of, East Germany was a Soviet vassal run as a police state. With this perception made, he says, only one course was open to the son of Manfred: resistance. His first thought was to establish an underground cell. He would select one or other elite patient who from time to time had given signs of dissatisfaction with the regime and proposition him or her. But to do what? And for how long? Mayflower's father, Manfred, had been betrayed by his comrades. In that regard, at least, the son did not propose to follow in the father's footsteps. So whom did he trust enough in all circumstances and all weathers? Answer, not even his mother Helga, an avowed communist, come what may. Very well, he reasoned, he would remain what he already was, a terrorist cell of one. He would emulate not his father but a boyhood hero, George Elser, the man who in 1939, without benefit of accomplice or confidant, had made, planted and detonated a bomb in the Munich beer cellar where minutes before the Führer had been addressing his faithful. Only infernal luck had saved him, Mayflower. But the GDR, he reasoned, was not a regime that could be blown away with a single blast, any more than Hitler's was. Mayflower was first and last a doctor. A rotten system must be treated from within. How to do that would reveal itself in due course. Meanwhile, he would confide in no one, trust in no one. He would be himself alone, sufficient to himself, answerable to himself. He would be a secret army of one. The chrysalis burst open, he maintains, when at 2200 hours on 18th of October 1958, a distraught young woman who was unknown to him rode her bicycle to Köpenick in the eastern suburbs of Berlin and presented herself at Mayflower's surgery, demanding an abortion. At which point Smiley's account breaks off, and it is Dr. Remek who is speaking to us directly. George must have felt that his account, for all its length, was too precious to compress. Comrade, deleted, is a highly intelligent woman of undoubted attraction, outwardly abrupt in the approved party manner, highly resourceful, but in the privacy of a medical consultation, intermittently childlike and defenseless. Though I am not given to off-the-cuff diagnoses of a patient's mental condition, I would tentatively suggest a form of selective schizophrenia, rigidly controlled. That she is also a woman of personal courage and high principle should not be perceived as a paradox. I inform comrade, deleted, that she is not pregnant and therefore requires no abortion. She tells me she is surprised to hear this, considering she slept with two equally repugnant men in the same cycle. She asks if I have any alcohol. She says she's not an alcoholic, but both her men drink heavily and she has acquired the habit. I offer her a glass of the French cognac given me by a Congolese minister of agriculture in gratitude for my medical services. Having swallowed it at one gulp, she interrogates me. Friends told me you're a decent man and discreet, are they right? She demands. Which friends? I ask. Secret friends. Why do your friends have to be secret? Because they're from the organs. Which organs? I have annoyed her. She snaps at me. The Stasi, comrade doctor, who do you think? I caution her. I may be a doctor, but I have my responsibilities to the state. She prefers not to hear me. She has a right to choose, she says. In a democracy where all comrades are equal, she can choose between a sadistic shit of a husband who beats her up and refuses to admit he's homosexual, and a fat 50-year-old swine of a boss who regards it as his good right to screw her in the back of his vulgar staff car any time he feels like it. She has twice in this conversation let fall the name of Dr. Emmanuel Rapp. She calls him the Rappschwein. I ask her whether this Rapp is any relation of comrade Bridget Rapp, who insists on consulting me for a range of illusory ailments. Yes, she confirms. Bridget is the name of the swine's wife. The connection is made. Frau Bridget Rapp has already confided to me that she is married to a senior Stasi functionary who does as he pleases. I am therefore in the presence of Dr. Emmanuel Rapp's very angry personal assistant and, according to her, secret mistress. She says she's considered putting arsenic into Rapp's coffee. She says she keeps a knife under the bed for the next time her homosexual husband assaults her. I advise her that these are dangerous fantasies and she should abandon them. I ask her whether she speaks in these seditious terms to her husband or in the workplace. She laughs and assures me she does not. She has three faces, she says. In this she is lucky because in the GDR most people have five or six. In the workplace, I am a devoted and diligent comrade. I am well-dressed and have orderly hair at all times, and especially at meetings, and I am also the sex slave of an illustrious swine. At home, I am the hate object of a sadistic, warm brother, homosexual, more than 10 years my senior, for whom the sole aim of life is to become a member of the Mayakovskiering elite and sleep with pretty young men. Her third identity is the one I see before me now. a woman who detests every aspect of life in the GDR except her son and has found secret solace in God the Father and his saints. I ask her who else she has confided this third identity to apart from myself. Nobody. I ask her whether she hears voices. She is not aware of doing so, but if she heard anyone's voice, it would be God's. I ask her whether she is indeed tempted to do herself harm, as she suggested to me earlier. She replies that she was recently minded to throw herself off a bridge, but was restrained by the love of her son, Gustav. I ask her whether she has been tempted to commit other demonstrative or vengeful acts, and she replies that on one recent occasion, when Dr. Emmanuel Rapp left his pullover on his chair one evening, she took a pair of scissors and hacked it to pieces, then gathered the pieces into a burn bag for secret waste. When Rapp returned next morning and complained that he had mislaid his pullover, she helped him look for it. When he decided that someone had stolen it, she suggested culprits. I ask her whether her vengeful feelings towards comrade Dr. Rapp have since abated. She retorts that they are stronger than ever, and the only thing she hates more than Rapp is the system that elevates swine like him to positions of power. Her hidden hatreds are alarming, and it is something of a miracle to me that she contrives to conceal them from the ever-vigilant eye of her work comrades. I ask her where she lives. She replies that she and her husband lived till recently in a Soviet-style apartment in the Stalin Allee, where there was no special protection and she had only a 10-minute cycle ride to Stasi headquarters in the Magdalenenstrasse. Recently, whether through homosexual influence or money she doesn't know, since her husband is secretive about the money that was left him by his father, they moved into a protected area in Berlin Hohenschönhausen set aside for government officials and higher civil servants. There are lakes and forest, which she loves, a playground for her son Gustav, and even a small private garden with a barbecue. In any other circumstances, the house would be an idyll, but sharing it with her odious husband makes it a mockery. She is a passionate cyclist, still rides her bicycle to work, and reckons half an hour from door to door. It is 1 a.m. I ask her what she will tell her husband Lothar when she gets home. She replies that she will tell him nothing and adds the following words. When my darling Lothar is not raping me or getting drunk, he sits on the edge of the bed with the GDR Foreign Office papers on his lap, growling and writing like a man who hates the whole world, not only his wife. I ask her whether these are secret papers that her husband brings home. She replies that they are extremely secret and that he brings them home illegally because in addition to being a sexual pervert, he is obsessively ambitious. She asks me whether, on the next occasion that she visits me, I will make love to her on the grounds that she has yet to make love to a man who is not a pig or a rapist. I believe she is joking, but I am not certain. In any event, I decline, explaining that I have made it a principle not to sleep with my patients. I leave her with the possible consolation of knowing that if I were not her doctor, I would sleep with her. As she mounts her bicycle to depart, she informs me that she has placed her life in my hands. I reply that, as a doctor, I shall respect her confidences. She asks me for a second appointment. I offer her next Thursday at 6 in the evening. Overcome by a wave of inner revulsion, I rise involuntarily to my feet. "Know where it is?" Nelson inquires without lifting his eyes from his book. I lock myself in the toilet, remain there as long as I dare. When I resume my place at the table, Doris Gamp, alias Tulip, has arrived punctually for her second appointment, having cycled all the way to Köpenick with her son Gustav riding in a basket. Remek again. The mood of mother and son is merry and relaxed. The weather is beautiful. Her husband Lothar has been summoned to a conference in Warsaw at short notice. He will not be back for 2 days. They are in high spirits. Tomorrow she and Gustav will bicycle to her sister Lottie, the only other person in the world I love, she informs me gaily. Entrusting the child to my dear mother, who wishes only that he were mine, I escort Comrade Deleted to my attic surgery and play Bach loudly on the gramophone. Ceremoniously, I would say skittishly, she presents me with a box of chocolates, which she says was given to her by Emmanuel Rapp, and advises me not to eat them all at once. On opening the box, I see that it contains, instead of Belgian chocolates, 2 cassettes of sub-miniature film. I sit on a stool beside her, her mouth close to my ear. I ask her what is in the sub-miniature film. She replies, Stasi secret documents. I ask her how she obtained them, and she replies that she photographed them this very afternoon with the aid of Emmanuel Rapp's own Minox camera in the wake of a particularly degrading sexual encounter. The act was barely consummated when the Rapschwein had scurried away to a meeting in House 2 for which he was already late. She was feeling vengeful and bold. The documents were strewn over his desk. His Minox camera lay in the drawer where he keeps it during the day. Stasi officers are supposed to be secure in their habits at all times, she tells me, adopting the tone of a Stasi apparatchik. The Rapschwein is so arrogant that he believes he is superior to service regulations. And the cassettes, I ask her? How will she account for them? The Rapschwein is infantile, therefore his whims must be gratified instantly, she says. It is totally forbidden even for officers of rank to keep special equipment such as secret cameras or recording devices in their personal safes, but Rapp ignores this edict, as others. Furthermore, on leaving the room in such haste, he actually left the safe door ajar, another flagrant breach of security, enabling her to bypass the wax lock. I ask her, what is a wax lock? She explains that on Stasi safes there is an elaborate lock which is capped by a coating of soft wax. On closing the safe, the rightful owner makes his own imprint in the wax using the Stasi-issued key and its attached signet, Petschaft, that he keeps on his person at all times. Each Petschaft is numbered, individually crafted, and unique to itself. As to cassettes, he has cardboard boxes full of them, a dozen at a time. He keeps no count of them and uses his Minox like a toy for many unofficial and dissolute purposes. For instance, he has tried many times to persuade her to pose naked for him, but she has always refused. He also keeps bottles of vodka and slivovitz in his safe, since like many Stasi bigwigs, he drinks heavily, and when drunk, speaks indiscreetly. I ask her how she succeeded in smuggling the sub-miniature film out of Stasi headquarters, and she giggled and replied that a doctor like me should know. However, she insists that, despite the Stasi's obsession with internal security, those with the correct passes are not subject to physical searches. For instance, Comrade Deleted has a pass entitling her to move at will between houses 1 and 3 of the Stasi complex. I ask her what she expects me to do with the cassettes now that she has compromised me with them, and she replies that I should kindly pass them to British intelligence. I ask why not American, and she is shocked. She is a communist, she says. Imperialist America is her enemy. We return downstairs. Gustav is playing dominoes with my dear mother. She reports that he is a delightful child and very good at dominoes, and she would like to steal him. Covert's technical arm, always on the lookout for an excuse to join the feast, chimes in. Berlin Covertech to H. Covert Berlin, Limas, Ray, your head agent, Mayflower. 1. You report his attic surgery in Köpenick contains old-style radio. Tech opts to adapt as recording device. 2. You report that Mayflower owns an Exacta single-lens reflex camera that is Stasi-approved for recreational use. He also owns a sun lamp for therapeutic use and, from his student days, a microscope. Since he already has the basic components, should he be instructed in the manufacture of microdots? 3. Köpenick is a rural, densely wooded area ideal for cachement of WT and other operational equipment. Stay behind team to reconnoiter and report. 4. Wax locks. In the course of Tulip's dalliances with Emmanuel Rapp, might she have occasion to take an impression of his personal safe key and attached signet, Petschaft? Technical stores have a wide variety of CDs, concealment devices, for containing suitable plasticine-type substances. The inner revulsion returns, in the course of her dalliances. They weren't Tulip's bloody dalliances, they were Rapschwein's, damn you. Tulip submitted to them because she knew if she didn't she'd be out on her ear on trumped-up disciplinary charges, and Gustav would never get to that elite school she dreamed of. And all right, she was a passionate woman and easily aroused. That does not mean she enjoyed herself either with the Rapschwein or with her husband. But in Berlin, Alec Limas had no such concerns. H. Covert Berlin, Limas, to H. Covert Marylebone, Smiley. D.O. letter, copy to file. Dear George, a perfect pour. happy to report that the impression of Emmanuel Rapp's pet shaft and key, covertly taken by subsource Tulip, has produced a clean facsimile with sharp lettering and numerals. The cowboys in tech have advised that for safety's sake she should apply a slight twist as she withdraws the pet shaft from the wax. So, doubles all round. Yours in the faith, Alec. P.S. Attached, Tulip's PP as per HO regs for coverts eyes only.